Now, over to you.
Okay. Well, I'm tempted to wait a couple of minutes, everyone, because we're looking at like nine people in addition to BL and I. But this first part, people can miss with no problem. So, this is the 66th webinar on the secret teachings. This webinar series is available on makara.us under the subheading Warrior Federation Webinars, then Webinar Series in Progress, as you see down here.
Okay, Francis, remember last time we talked about me adding Robert's ongoing series in there? Well, number one, it finishes next month. And
Okay.
number two, I haven't found any recordings for it. So
Okay.
I'm not going to add that. So if anybody was looking to see Robert's stuff here,
Not.
you're not going to see it. So sorry about that. It's a good series.
Yeah.
But sometimes a lot of the material he uses is copyrighted, so
Yeah,
he doesn't
right. Well, there's that.
necessarily do recordings of it.
Yeah, you're right, and that could be the reason. You can, see him live by going to the Mori Federation calendar and finding, and they send out announcements on him. But yeah, he may not, he may choose not to record them just because of that. So anyway, previous episodes of this, The Secret Doctrine, and the Treatise on Cosmic Fire series are also available on YouTube. Just do a search for Francis Donald and the webinar series you wish to view. You can join any of these webinars right here in the upper left corner of the homepage of moriafederation.com. This is a little panel that shows all the current active webinars that are ongoing, the current ongoing active webinars. So that's a good resource. Just you don't even have to get into the calendar, which is here below it. You can just link up right there. Okay. We began our last session by taking a look at the final paragraph of the chapter entitled The Zodiac and Its Signs. We've been in there, I think, for eight or nine sessions, where we learned about the planetary correlations with the seven stages of human life. We then analyzed the chart that appears in the middle of the last page, which has a number of unusual features, including a triform figure in the center, the fact that the zodiacal houses are numbered from the bottom, as well as some unusual depictions of the zodiacal signs, such as the figure of Anubis shaking a sistrum in one hand while holding a leash of a docile goat-headed Makara for the sign of Capricorn. We then turned a page revealing a silver-printed fold-out depicting the Mensa Issiaca, which MPH has chosen to call the Bimbine Table of Isis, and a new chapter by the same name. Here's the original Bimbine Table of Isis. It is an elaborate bronze tablet with enamel and silver inlay. In fact, there's many different metals involved. I read just a strictly a scientific document about this that did these spectrum X-ray analysis that showed all the different layers. It's really a quite a thing, actually. Quite a you could say a victory of the metallurgic arts of that first century AD. Yeah, it was created in a style that mimics ancient Egyptian art. I mean, it looks Egyptian, but it actually is of Roman origin and dates to the first century AD. Interestingly, because the Egyptian Empire was still intact, but the secrets of the hieroglyphs and there you can't see them very well here, but there are hieroglyphs throughout this were unknown to the Romans. Those codes were not broken by the Romans. So that's why I say Egyptian. It mimics the Egyptian, but it's not actually Egyptian. Next, we took a look at the caption, this really long caption that accompanies the foldout, which is made up of one long quote from Athanasius's Kircher's Oedipus Aegyptiacus. Here we learned about the practices of the ancient Egyptian priests, which included healing rituals, protective magic, funerary rites, daily temple rituals, and divination. Next, we learned about the meticulous attention to detail and precise execution in the performance of the Egyptian theurgic rites, as described by Iamblichus, and which has been preserved in various surviving papyri. Finally, we learned about hieromancy, a form of divination that involves interpreting the remains of sacrificial offerings or sacred objects, which was used to gain insight or predict future events by studying the patterns and conditions of these offerings. And that takes us up to where we left off last time. We'll now continue with the caption. We're almost to the end of it. Accompanying the Mensa Isiaca. Could we get a reader, please, for this passage?
Sure, I'll start. Since each of the orders of gods had its own peculiar symbols, gestures, costumes, and ornaments, they thought it necessary to observe these in the whole apparatus of worship, as nothing was more officious in drawing the benign attention of the deities and genii. Thus, their temples, remote from the usual haunts of men, contained representations of nearly every form in nature. First, in the pavement, they symbolized the physical economy of the world, using minerals, stones, and other things suitable for ornaments, including little streams of water. The walls showed the starry world and the dome of the world of genii. In the center was the altar to suggest the emanations of the supreme mind from its center. Thus, the entire interior constituted a picture of the universe of worlds. Priests, in making sacrifices, wore raiment adorned with figures similar to those attributed to the gods. Their bodies were partially bare, like those of the deities, and they themselves were divested of all material cares and practiced the strictest chastity.
Thank you, BL. So first, since each of the orders of gods had its own peculiar symbols, gestures, costumes, and ornaments, they, meaning the priests, thought it necessary to observe these in the whole apparatus of worship, as nothing was more efficacious in drawing the benign attention of the deities and genii. Okay, so following are four examples of quote unquote order of the gods found in ancient Egypt. These are just short little descriptions. So let's have one reader to read all four. Okay.
Greg, would you read those for us, please?
Yep.
Oop, you've got a bad echo.
Ennead of Heliopolis. This is one of the most famous groups consisting of nine deities worshipped in Heliopolis. The Ennead includes Adam, Shu, Tefnut, Gep, Nut, Osiris, Isis, Set, and Nephthys.
Okay, continue.
Ogdoad of Hermopolis. This group consists of 8 deities representing the primordial elements of creation. The Ogdoad includes Amun, Amunet, He, Hauhet, Kek, Kauket, Nun, and Naunet.
And next?
The triad of Thebes. This triad includes Amun, his consort Mut, and their son Khonsu. They were primarily worshipped in Thebes and played a significant role in the religious life of the city.
Thank you, Greg. Oh no, there's one more. Go ahead.
And the triad of Memphis. This group consists of Ptah, his consort Sekhmet, and their son Nefertum. They were central to the religious practices in Memphis.
Okay, so you can see, you know, what a complex scene the Egyptian theogony was. Of course, these unfolded at greatly different times over the history of Egypt. And each of them had their own symbols, gestures, costumes, ornaments, etc. Right? Okay, the quote unquote symbols, gestures, costumes, and ornaments were specific to each of the four.
Did you want me to continue?
No. Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it, Greg. okay, so as I was saying, the
since each of the orders of
Greg,
gods
Greg,
had its
Greg,
own peculiar symbols, gestures.
Greg? Can you hear me, Greg?
I muted him.
Oh, thank you.
Greg, he did not want you to continue. He's doing his discussion of it now.
Okay. All right. So, yeah. So all these aspects, you know, the symbols, gestures, costumes, and ornaments were specific to each of the four pantheons. Though there were also common symbols and costumes among these four hierarchies. For example, the Ankh, scepter, and Was stick were carried by gods and goddesses in all four pantheons. The most individual aspect of the Egyptian deities were their headdresses and or crowns, as shown here. The most unusual grouping was the Ogdoad of Hermopolis, where, for example, Nonet was often depicted with a serpent head and Nun with a frog's head. Next. Thus, their temples, remote from the usual haunts of men, contained representations of nearly every form in nature. First, in the pavement, they symbolized the physical economy of the world using minerals, stones, and other things suitable for ornaments, including little streams of water. The walls showed the starry world, and the dome, the world of genii. In the center was the altar, to suggest the emanations of the supreme mind from its center. So the Egyptian temples were unparalleled in size and in the scope of their influence and activities in the ancient world. For example, here's the Karnak temple complex in Luxor. And here's a series of meticulously researched reconstructions of the complex created by Mark Milmore, who's dedicated his life to these reconstructions, that reveals something of its past glory. And you can see some of the aspects of what's talked about here, not so much the pavement, but with the walls and the ceilings. Finally, thus the entire interior constituted a picture of the universe of worlds. The priests, in making sacrifices, wore raiments adorned with figures similar to those attributed to the gods. Their bodies were partially bare, like those of the deities, and they themselves were divested of all material cares and practiced the strictest chastity. So the layout and decoration of the temples symbolized the universe at the moment of creation. The innermost sections of the temple, usually the most sacred, represented the primordial hill that emerged from the chaotic waters of Nun, with the floor, walls, and ceiling designed to represent different aspects of the universe. The progression from the outer part of the temple to the inner sanctum often involved rising floor levels and decreasing ceiling heights, symbolizing the journey from the earthly realm to the divine. The rituals performed within the temple were believed to maintain the order of the universe. The priests, through their ceremonies and offerings, reenacted the creation and sustained the cosmic balance. Just on a personal note, I visited Egypt three different times, and I was able to gain permission of one of the guards and get into these temple complexes by myself after they closed. And they have such extraordinary potency of vibration and presence when you don't have 1,000 tourists walking around. They're really something. Okay, next up, could we get a reader, please?
Yes, and Veronica, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. The heads were veiled to indicate their charge of earthly things. The heads and bodies were shaved, for they regarded hair as useless excrescence. Upon the heads they bore the same insignia as those attributed to the gods. Thus arrayed, they regarded themselves to be transformed into that intelligence with which they constantly desire to be identified. For example, in order to call down to the world the soul and spirit of the universe, they stood before the image shown in the center of a tablet, wearing the same symbols as that figure and its attendants, and offered sacrifices. By these and the accompanying singings of hymns, they believed that they infallibly drew the gods' attention to their prayer. And so they did in regard to other regions of the tablet, believing of necessity the proper ritual, properly carried out, would evoke the deity desired. That this was the origin of the signs of oracles is apparent, as a touch chord produces a harmony of sound. Likewise, the joining chords respond through not touched.
Thank you, Veronica. Okay. First, their heads were veiled to indicate their charge of earthly things. Their head and bodies were shaved, for they regarded hair as a useless excrescence. Not a word you see every day. Upon the head, they bore the same insignia as those attributed to the gods. So veiled heads were considered to be symbolic of the priest's role in performing rituals that maintained the order of the physical world. Removing hair was a form of ritual preparation, ensuring that priests were in a state of cleanliness and purity before performing sacred ceremonies. They bore the same insignia and headdresses as the gods they represented, not as a mark of their status, but rather so that through identification, they might better align with the gods and thus become effective intermediaries between the gods and the people they served. Of course, this is those kingdoms who were most potently connected with the realm of deity, one might say. I think some of the later kingdoms, this quality fell away and ego came in, and that was in part one of the reasons for the final end of the Egyptian Empire. But for literally thousands and thousands of years, the priests were great initiates along with the pharaoh, and really did bring the force of deity into the lives of the Egyptian people. Next. By the way, I invite you to comment and question any time you'd like. That's always more interesting when we have a conversation than just me going on and on with this lecture. Okay, so next up, thus arrayed, they regarded themselves to be transformed into that intelligence with which they constantly desired to be identified. That's an important statement. For example, in order to call down to the world the soul and spirit of the universe, they stood before the image shown in the center of our tablet, wearing the same symbols as that figure and its attendants, and offered sacrifices. So the idea of transforming themselves into that intelligence with which they constantly desire to be identified stands at the root of all shamanic practice and is also a tenet of theosophy. They were not worshiping a separate and distant god, but invoking that god so that it might manifest through them. The image at the center of the tablet is Isis, shown here in an actual Egyptian frieze, with similar garb and symbols. Next, by these and the accompanying singing of hymns, they believed that they infallibly drew the gods' attention to their prayer. And so they did in regard to their other, and so they did in regard to other regions of the tablet, believing of necessity the proper ritual properly carried out would evoke the deity desired. Egyptian hymns were renowned among the ancients for their beauty, their poetic structure, their emotional, spiritual, and spiritual depth, and their literary excellence. For example, this hymn to Isis is a well-known example, and if you'll bear with me, I'll read it. Of course, we have no musical notation from this period, so we've lost any form of melody. And so in a sense, the hymns have become poems. O wealth giver, queen of the gods, Hermotis, lady omnipresent Agathe Tike, greatly renowned Isis, Deo, highest discoverer of all life. Manifold miracles were your care that you might bring livelihood to mankind and mortality to all. You taught customs that justice might in some measure prevail. You gave skills that men's life might be comfortable. And you discovered the blossoms that produced edible vegetation. Because of you, heaven and the whole earth have their being, and the gusts of the winds and the sun with its sweet light. By your power, the channels of Nile are filled every one, At the harvest season, its most turbulent water is poured on the whole land that produce may be unfailing. All mortals who live on the boundless earth express your fair name, a name greatly honored among all. Hear my prayers, O one whose name has great power. Prove yourself merciful to me and free me from all distress. Okay. And then, yeah, this is I don't know if it's the same hymn to Isis. There were many of them, but it's one of them in hieroglyphics. Okay, and then finally, that this was the origin of the science of oracles is apparent, as a touched chord produces a harmony of sound. Likewise, the adjoining chords respond, though not touched. Athanasius Kircher here suggests that the Egyptian priest's ability to receive and transmit divine messages marked the origin of oracles. I think it's quite likely. Just as a touched chord produces our harmonious sound, divine messages, we're here told, resonate through the priests to those they serve, and thus influences the surrounding environment. I see a hand.
Yes, but first, Joe, hold on a minute. Ben says, and he typed this a little while ago, but it goes great with what you just said. He says, matching the vibration of the gods by the insignias, eyes are tuned to certain wavelengths of light, visible light. Ears are tuned to certain frequencies of sound, audible sound. So we are noticed by the masters when our vibration is love for all beings.
Yeah, I think it, in the highest form of identification, it goes way beyond noticed. It literally, you become entrained by great beings, and in a sense are them. They are using your vehicle to express in the outer worlds. You know, that's among the greatest of the priests might have had that. You know, there's so many stories that we'll never hear about the great ones of those many thousands of years of expression. Thanks for that, Ben.
Okay, go ahead, Joe.
Yes, I want to say how excited I am about this. I've studied shamanism a fair amount, and particularly American Indian medicine wheel work. And while I associate my own self with animals, it never occurred to me. It's like opening up a encyclopedia and recognizing the connection that goes into the lower kingdoms below the the human level. It's just a whole new world, not just light and sound, but all of these different objects.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, I completely hear you. I studied with an Apache shaman for a couple of years. It was an extraordinary experience. And what I discovered is that, you know, their orientation towards the animal was really an orientation towards the overshadowing devas of those animals. For instance, I worked with the deer, and the point was to have an experience of that devic presence that shines forth through the entire realm of deer. You're not worshiping deer, you know, that, you know, you know, that's a total misunderstanding of what's going on. In shamanism, you're invoking the presence of those devic beings. And for those where shamanism is relevant, and, you know, I would say mostly this belongs to the past because the invocations were towards, you know, providing, for instance, food and clothing for the tribe, you know, to gain information for healing from, for instance, the plant kingdom and the devas that overshadowed that kingdom, right? So it was, in a way, shamanism is a very practical science. It has spiritual elements, certainly, but that's enough on that. Okay. Could we get a reader, please, for this next stage?
Sure, Joe, can you read that for us, please?
Sure.
And before you do that, there's Greg says the divas are always speaking if we can just attune ourselves to their sounds, like the birds in the morning, or even the very subtle levels of wind blowing through the trees.
Absolutely right, Greg. That's exactly right. There's a whole science of reading nature, you know, omens, but also just the daily happenings through things like the change of wind direction and, you know, flight of birds or any sounds or the appearance of a particular animal or, you know, this is a science that was deeply explored by, probably indigenous tribes all over the world, certainly the American Indian.
Right.
Okay, go ahead, Joe.
Similarly, the idea they expressed by their concurrent acts while adoring the god came into accord with basic idea, and by an intellectual union, it was returned to them deiformed, and they thus obtained the idea of ideas. Hence, there sprang up in their souls, they thought, the gift of prophecy and divination, and they believed they could foretell future events, impending evils, etc. For as in the supreme mind, everything is simultaneous and spaceless, the future is therefore present in that mind, and they thought that while the human mind was absorbed in the supreme by contemplation, by that union they were enabled to know all the future. Nearly all that is represented in our tablet consists of amulets, which by analogy above described would inspire them under the described conditions with the virtues of the supreme power and enable them to receive good and avert evil. They also believe they could in this magical manner effect cures of diseases that genii could be induced to appear to them during sleep and cure or teach them to cure the sick.
Okay, I would, you know, if I was MPH, I would change the wording a little bit and say, instead of things they believed they could in this magical factor, they did affect cures, you know, that were proven over generations, hundreds of generations indeed, right? This was a fine art in Egyptian times, you know. So it wasn't that they thought they could do it, you know, they were exponents of these occult sciences. Okay, so first up, similarly, the idea they expressed by their concurrent acts while adoring the gods came into accord with basic idea, capital I, and by an intellectual union, it was returned to them, deiformed, and they thus obtained the idea of ideas. So deiformed means the transformation of an idea into a form that resembles or embodies the divine. Kircher is here saying that the sum total of the priest's theurgical approach, including preparatory ablutions, precisely worded invocations in accordance with known magical formulas, costumery, symbols, chants, and fervent devotion together worked to inform a combined idea, a unified idea, that through higher mental union with their God, allowed these priests to access the higher realm of ideas. If you're a DK Theosophist, those are believed to be live in the realm of the Atmic plane, described here as deiformed, and even a level beyond this, the source of all ideas, which Kircher here calls the idea of ideas. This is incredibly theosophic here. This is a very esoteric statement supported by the teachings of Alice Bailey. Next. Hence there sprung up in their souls, they thought, he's got to distance himself, and never mind. They thought the gift of prophecy and divination, and they believed they could foretell future events impending. So if we strip away those conditional phrases, we got, hence there sprung up in their souls the gift of prophecy and divination, and they could foretell future events, impending evils, etc. So all prophets and seers are, through their intuition, in touch with some higher source. Those Egyptian priests who were true initiates would certainly have been in this category. Thus, their access to the realm of ideas would have been sanctioned by, and their prophecies would have been in keeping with, hierarchical intent. Next, for as in the supreme mind, everything is simultaneous and spaceless, the future is therefore present in that mind. And they thought that while the human mind was absorbed in the supreme by contemplation, by that union, they were enabled to know all the future. This is good writing. So DK tells us that only Sanat Kumara is able to know the future with complete infallibility, and he's not telling. This is because the human kingdom has been given the freedom to choose their thoughts and actions, and therefore determine their own way forward. Thus, only trends can be determined based on lines of energy leading to likely outcomes. That said, a vision of the unfoldment of human progress would certainly have been available to the Egyptian initiate. An example being Hermes Trismegistus, who accessed the universal mind called by him Pymander or Pymander. Next. Nearly all that is represented in our tablet consists of amulets, which by analogy above described would inspire them under the described conditions with the virtues of the supreme power and enable them to receive good and avert evil. Again, we have to remember that this tablet is not Egyptian in origin and therefore was not used by Egyptian priests. Nonetheless, amulets were a very real part of Egyptian theurgy. Let's again turn to EgyptMythology.com for further insight. Can we get a reader, please? These are some examples of the amulets that have been found sewn in the garments, funerary garments of the Egyptians. Primarily that. Can we get a reader, please?
Magda, can you read that for us, please? Magda, can you read that for us, please? Okay, let's go with Marguerite. Marguerite, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. I have a image blocking the print in my phone, so if you bear with me just for a second. Starting with Egyptian amulets were believed to possess profound spiritual and protective powers that extended far. I'm trying to get rid of the picture. I guess far beyond their physical form. Here are some key aspects of the revelatory power. One, spiritual protection. Amulets were thought to ward off evil spirits and negative energies, providing a shield protection to the wearer. Two, symbolic significance. Each amulet carried specific symbols and inscriptions that invoked the power of the gods and goddesses. For example, the Eye of Horus symbolized protection, health, and restoration. Three, magical properties. Amulets were often made from materials believed to have inherent magical properties, such as gold for eternity and divine connection, or lapis lazuli for protection against evil. Personalization. Amulets were sometimes inscribed with the names of the bearers or specific invocations, enhancing their protective qualities and making them unique to the individual. Five, funerary practices. In burial rituals, amulets were placed with the deceased to ensure safe passage into the afterlife and eternal protection.
Okay, I would add to this that amulets were imbued with potency through meditation, through directed meditation, and so that they could literally be a, could hold that divine potency for various reasons. For instance, in a temple, amulets would maintain a certain potency even when the priests were not performing ceremonies. The same could be said for, in the homes. In funerary practices, these divine potencies then would help guide the deceased to a mentee in the afterlife. So, they had a very important function. Okay. Finally, they also believe they could, in this magical manner, affect cures of diseases. That genie could be induced to appear to them during sleep and cure or teach them to cure the sick. So, again, I would just say that they did, in a magical manner, affect cures of diseases, and genie could and would appear for this process of affecting cures, right? Okay, so genie, these are genie here, are intermediaries between the gods and humans, conveying divine messages and ensuring that the will of the gods is carried out. They were invoked through certain specific magical spells and rituals for purposes of protection, healing, and guidance. There were also malevolent genii who had to be appeased to prevent harm and misfortune. And putting these two together, the amulets and the genies, I would think that they could embody an amulet. And there were also amulets made in the form of genies. So this is deep magical practice. And what is magic anyway? It's the affecting of a particular result on the physical plane that has its source on higher planes. Okay, next up, the last paragraph of the caption for the illustration of the Mensa Isiaka. Could we get a reader, please?
Maria, can you read that for us, please?
Sure. In this belief, they consulted the gods about all sorts of doubts and difficulties, while adorned with the simulacra of the mystic rite and intently contemplating the divine ideas. And while so enraptured, they believed the god by some sign, nod or gesture communicated with them, whether asleep or awake, concerning the truth or falsity of the matter in point. From Oedipus Aegypticus.
Thank you. Okay, so simulacra here refers to costumery that identified the priests with the gods they were aligning with. Again, we have a description of the priest's ability to access and communicate with the gods through the highly developed mystic rites of the priesthood of ancient Egypt. So, any final thoughts or questions on this long quote from Oedipus Aegyptiacus? Okay.
Wait a minute. Sometimes it takes time to type.
Yeah.
Ben says the four genii we saw are the sons of Horus and deities of the canopic jars, holding safe the innards for future use.
Yeah, that's one interpretation and a correct one. There's also the purpose of protection is very strong. You know, the things like mummified intestines, etc., is very vulnerable to attack from the dark forces. And these genii would be used to protect, you know, I think of the Canopus jars that surrounded Akhenaten, you know, the 14th dynasty pharaoh, and just how extraordinarily beautiful they are, but also how powerful the presentation of those four genii surrounding the Canopus jars was, and right, and the lids of the Canopus jars too are these genies. So, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Thanks for that.
Greg says, I think this relates to premonitions or precognition. If those of you are starting to get instances of these in your own lives.
It was this science of premonition and precognition, you know, this was daily life for the priests. They were in a definite connection with the gods and continuously made use of that over centuries. Yes, I see another hand.
Go ahead, Barbara.
Yes, so I think this the whole of this in some way describes the role of higher beings from Sirius, the Pleiades, the Great Bear, to birth humanity. So it wasn't just priests asking for this insight or whatever. There was an overall plan to start evolution. And this is sort of, in some ways, a blueprint to get evolution started again after the Atlantic floods.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Barbara. Yeah, it's the bigger perspective. And I think you're absolutely right. They were one of the main agencies for reestablishing the new root race, or establishing the new root race, right? It was happened in both India and Egypt, Babylonia, and to a lesser extent, all the mystery schools around the Mediterranean. But yes, you know, for instance, the 42 books that came through Hermes Trismegistus, where I think the whole purpose was to reestablish the arts, the healing arts, the sciences, etc. And this was all done through the priests. The priests weren't like priests now, you know. Priests were educators, scientists, every kind of occupation you could think of, or at least the higher occupations, would have been a class of priests, you know, that that took that up. You had dancing priests, you had priests, musicians. So, thank you. Okay, so next up, we begin the chapter entitled The Bimbin Table of Isis. So could we get a reader, please?
Scott, can you read that for us, please?
The Bimbin Table of Isis. The manuscript, a manuscript by Thomas Taylor, contains the following remarkable paragraph. Plato was initiated into the greater mysteries at the age of 49. The initiation took place in one of the subterranean halls of the Great Pyramid in Egypt. The Isaic table formed the altar before which the divine Plato stood and received that which was always his, but which the ceremony of the mysteries enkindled and brought from its dormant state. With this ascent, after 3 days in the great hall, he was received by the Hierophant of the pyramids. The Hierophant was seen only by those who had passed the 3 days, the 3 degrees, the 3 dimensions, and given verbally the highest esoteric teachings, each accompanied with its appropriate symbol. After a further 3 months' sojourn in the halls of the pyramid, the initiate Plato was sent out into the world to do the work of the great order, as Pythagoras and Orpheus had been before him. Before the sacking of Rome in 1527, there was no historical mention of the Mensa Isaic, Table of Isis. At that time, the tablet came into the possession of a certain locksmith or iron worker, who sold it at an exorbitant price to Cardinal Bembo, a celebrated antiquary, historiographer, and of the Republic of Venice, and afterwards librarian of St. Mark's. After his death in 1547, the Isaic tablet was acquired by the House of Mantua, in whose museum it reigned until 1630. When troops of Ferdinand II captured the city of Mantua. Several early writers on the subject have assumed that the tablet was demolished by the ignorant soldiery for the silver it contained. The assumption, however, was erroneous. The tablet fell into the hands of Cardinal Pava, who presented it to the Duke of Savoy, who in turn presented it to the King of Sardinia. When the French conquered Italy in 1797, the tablet was carried to Paris. In 1809, Alexandre Lenoir, writing of the Mensa Isiaca, said it was on exhibition at the Bibliothèque Nationale. Upon the establishment of peace between the two countries, it was returned to Italy. In his guide of Northern Italy, Carl Baedeker describes the Mensa Isaica as being in the center of Gallery 2 in the Museum of Antiquities at Turin.
Thanks, Scott. By the way, I did a little bit of research. It's still in this museum, a museum in Turin. I couldn't find out whether it was still in Gallery 2, but, you know, walk around a little bit. If you get to Turin, it would be worth seeing. Okay, first up, a manuscript by Thomas Taylor contains the following remarkable paragraph. Plato was initiated into the greater mysteries at the age of 49. The initiation took place in one of the subterranean halls of the Great Pyramid in Egypt. Well, I have access to all of Thomas Taylor's published works. I could not find where to which of those works this quote is attributed, but there is no question that Plato was acquainted with the greater mysteries of the Eleusinian school, and many authors acknowledge this fact, beginning with Plutarch in 75 AD in his book, The Life of Alcibiades. According to G.R.S. Mead's Orpheus, he states, "In things pertaining to theology, there were in former times six great teachers expounding similar doctrines. The first was Zoroaster, the chief of the Magi. The second, Hermes Trismegistus, the head of the Egyptian priesthood. Orpheus succeeded Hermes. Aglaophamus was initiated into the sacred mysteries of Orpheus. Pythagoras was initiated into theology by Aglaophamus, that's what it is, Aglaophamus, I never heard of, and Plato by Pythagoras. Plato summed up the whole of their wisdom in his letters." So this is quite an attribute. There's only one known subterranean chamber in the Great Pyramid. And this could have been used for initiation. It's possible. The 49th year is significant as it marks completion of 7 times 7 year periods. Next, of course, there is absolutely no evidence, any kind of written evidence that this took place, but it was believed to be the case by a number of ancient authors, so that in itself has some authority. So next, the Isiac tablet table formed the altar before which the divine Plato stood and received that which was always his, but which the ceremony of the mysteries enkindled and brought from its dormant state. Well, since Plato lived 400 years before the Isiac table was crafted, it certainly was not on the altar during his initiation. The quote, Plato receiving that which was always his, but which the ceremony of the mysteries enkindled and brought from its dormant state, suggests a rekindled awareness of his soul. With that which was always his being his soul's ancient authority. That's my interpretation anyway. Any thoughts or questions? You know, it's a fascinating idea that Plato went to Egypt and was initiated, and it's known that he went to Egypt. It's written by a number, but it was believed actually that he was there in earlier life, in his 20s, for education, and that he was actually very involved in his own school in Athens at the supposed time that he was initiated. But who's to know, you know, that he didn't take a trip to Egypt during his 49th year and receive initiation. Yes, Scott.
I'm just wondering, when I see 49, we're talking about Plato. My first thought is that it's symbolic,
mm-hmm.
considering who Plato, we know Plato, who he was and is. I'm thinking the 7 times 7 is symbolic, not really that age, but I don't know.
Yeah, it marks the same kind of completion that initiation marks. Yeah, I think that's a good observation. So, you know, and at the same time, I believe he did take initiation, you know. How that unfolded, you know, we have no record, but. Okay, another hand.
Anita, please go ahead.
Yes, I don't think it's symbolic because every septenary in the age you live for marks a very precise opportunity to take an initiation. So 49, 7 by 7, it's a a very important one. We have until 70, but you can get granted even until 80 or 84 if you have to carry on a karmic task that you haven't managed to. So it's very precise, this thing. I think so.
Well, let me put this out. A symbolic age can also be very precise, right? Because, and if they happen to align in real time, that too can be significant. But a symbolic age of initiation suggests a particular stage of development, of becoming, right? And the actual time of initiation, it's if it happens to fall. Here's what I'm suggesting, that the vagaries of travel and time and space at that time might have prevented Plato from actually being in the pyramid at that time. But nonetheless, he could have taken initiation in Egypt, and it would have been demonstrative, or that 49th year level of progress would have been conferred on him, whether it was actually in that 49th year or not. That was my point. Okay. Where in the heck are we here? Oh, yeah. Next, the Issiac table. Wait a minute. I read that. Next. With this ascent, after 3 days in the Great Hall, he was received by the Hierophant of the Pyramid. Hierophant was seen only by those who had passed the 3 days, the 3 degrees, the 3 dimensions, and given verbally the highest esoteric teachings, each accompanied with its appropriate symbol. Okay, as I've said, there is no direct evidence that any of what is here described took place. There is no Great Hall in the pyramid, though MPH might be referring to the Grand Gallery, which connects the Queen and King's Chamber, but this really is a passage and not a room. Hierophant is a Greek term specifically associated with the Eleusinian mysteries in ancient Greece. The ancient Egyptians had their own titles and terms for their religious and ceremonial leaders, such as high priest or hymnator, servant of God. Finally, a period of purification was common in many ancient rites, though there is no specific reference to a 3-day waiting period. None of this is to say that Plato wasn't initiated in Egypt. For many, even ancient sources say that he was, but the particulars of that initiation have never been published. Okay, next. After a further 3 months sojourn in the halls of the pyramid, the initiate Plato was sent out into the world to do the work of the great order, as Pythagoras and Orpheus had been before him. If true, the 3 months would have been used for further education, to further educate the newly initiated Plato, that he might more effectively take up the mantle worn by Zoroaster, Hermes Trismegistus, Aglaophamus, Orpheus, and Pythagoras before him, as described by G.R.S. Mead. There's an interesting legend about Plato being initiated into the mysteries of the goddess Neith, who is an aspect of Isis, by Sonchis of Sais. This is not historically verifiable, but the book in which Plato incorporates the history of Atlantis in his dialogues, it's actually in his dialogues, suggests a connection with Sonchis, who schooled the statesman Solon on the history of Atlantis. So possibly he went to Sais and was initiated by this great, renowned priest sewn cheese. The next paragraph describes the history of the Mensa Ithiaca after its discovery in 1527, which, and you know, I see no reason to go over this, except to say that the Mensa Ithiaca can still be found in the Museum of Antiquities in Turin. It's, and you know, it's fascinating that it was so valued, clearly revered, that it, you know, took this trail from king to king, you know, for centuries, actually, right? Okay. All right, so next up, can we get a reader, please? This, yeah.
Sorry. Yeah, okay. Let me see. Barbara, can you read that for us, please?
Yes. The Benbin Table of Isis continued. A faithful reproduction of the original tablet was made in 1559 by the celebrated Aeneas Ficus of Parma. And a copy of the engraving was given by the Chancellor of the Duke of Bavaria to the Museum of Hieroglyphics. Athanasius Kircher describes the tablet as 5 palms long and 4 wide. W. Wynne Westcott says it measures 50 by 30 inches. It was made of bronze and decorated with encaustic or smelt enamel and silver inlay. Fosbroke adds, the figures are cut very shallow and the contour of most of them is encircled by threads of silver. The basis upon which the figures were seated or reclined and left blank in the prints were of silver and are torn away. See the Encyclopedia of Antiquities. Those familiar with the fundamental principles of Hermetic philosophy will recognize in the Mensa Ithiaca the key to Chaldean, Egyptian, and Greek theology. In his Antiquities, the learned Benedict Father Montfaucon admits his inability to cope with the intricacies of its symbolism. He therefore doubts that the emblems upon the tablet possess any significance worthy of consideration, and ridicules Kircher, declaring him to be more obscure than the tablet itself. Laurentius Pignorius reproduced the tablet in connection with a descriptive essay in 1605, but his timidly advanced explanations demonstrated his ignorance concerning the actual interpretation of the figures.
Okay, thank you, Barbara. Again, interesting, but I don't see any need to further explore the tablet's history. It's interesting to know its size. This is quite large. It's like, you know, just over 4 foot by just under 3 feet. Yeah, if you have any thoughts on this, fine. But otherwise, we'll get into more into the meaning, which comes okay. Next. Yeah.
Greg has some thoughts. He says, I wonder if there is any context to these supposed initiations of Plato to be identified or connected with being initiated in the inner worlds or on the inner planes through meditation and contemplation. We would have to recognize and understand who Plato's primary followers are and how they would have known. It reminds me of the initiations of the Christ. So much of those initiations are testified by his disciples in the context of his human qualities as understood and described by the apostles in their testaments.
Yeah, interesting. I don't know of any description by the apostles of Plato, but DK mentions Plato and calls him a master. So he was, you know, no question, a high initiate And it seems almost it's more than likely. It's as much of a certainty as we can say without knowing the facts, that he was indeed initiated during his lifetime in Greece. We just don't know the particulars of that. But as a master of wisdom, and I would put him at the level of a fifth-rate master. He would have had a very specific purpose, which was to establish and carry on the school of Pythagoras in his own Greek school. It really marked the high point of Greek. Whoops, what did I do that for? The high point of Greek philosophical gifting to the world, I would say. Okay, can we get a reader, please?
All right. Ben, can you read that for us, please? Ben? Okay, well, there we
Okay.
go.
Yes, I believe I can. Starting with the Bembine table, what's showing? A faithful reproduction of the original tablet was made in 1559 by the celebrated Aeneas Ficus of Parma.
Hold on, hold on, hold on. I'm sorry. We need to shift it down. Go ahead now.
In his Oedipus Egyptiacus, published in 1654, Kircher attacked the problem with characteristic avidity. Being peculiarly qualified for such a task by years of research in matters pertaining to the secret doctrines of antiquity. And with the assistance of a group of eminent scholars, Kircher accomplished much towards an exposition of the mysteries of the tablet. The master secret, however, eluded even him, as Eliphas Levi was shrewdly noted in his History of Magic. The learned Jesuit, writes Levy, divined that it contained the hieroglyphic key to secret alphabets. Though he was unable to develop the explanation, it is divided into three equal compartments. Above are the 12 houses of heaven, and below are the corresponding distributions of labor, work periods, throughout the year. While in the middle place are 21 sacred signs answering to the letters of the alphabet. In the midst of all is a seated figure of the panthropomorphic Onyx, emblem of universal being and corresponding as such to the Hebrew Yod, or to that unique letter from which all other letters were formed. The Onyx is encircled by the Ophite triad, answering to the three mother letters of the Egyptian and Hebrew alphabets. On the left are the Ibymorphic and Serapion triads. On the right, left, are those Nephs and Hecate representing active and passive, fixed and volatile, fructifying fire and generating water. Each pair of triads in conjunction with the center produces a septenary, and a septenary is contained in the center. The three septenaries furnish the absolute number of the three worlds, as well as the complete number of primitive letters, to which a complementary sign is added, like zero to the nine numerals.
Thank you. I need to make a correction here. There we go. Okay. Okay. So First, a paragraph on Athanasius Kircher's work with the Bensa Isiaca. Kircher was convinced that the tablet contained encoded knowledge that could reveal deeper spiritual truths about the Egyptian mysteries. For example, Kircher believed that the arrangement of figures and symbols on the tablet depicted the cosmic order and a hierarchy of divine beings. He saw the tablet as a map of the universe, illustrating the relationships between different cosmic principles and their roles in the creation and maintenance of the cosmos. Kircher also interpreted some of the symbols on the tablet as alchemical in nature, representing the process of spiritual purification symbolized by the transformation of matter. Next. The learned Jesuit, writes Levi, divined that it contained the hieroglyphic key to sacred alphabets, though he was unable to develop the explanation. It is divided into three equal compartments. Above are the 12 houses of heaven, and below are the corresponding distributions of labor or work periods through the year, while in the middle place are 21 sacred signs answering to the letters of the alphabet. Okay, so here's the Mensi Isiaca, which does indeed have 12 figures in the upper register, and which, according to Kircher, represents the 12 houses of heaven. But there's little consensus on the identity of these figures. I just included this as a one of that what's that? One of the X-rays, for lack of a better word, of the Mensi Isiaca, which brought forth copper element, but it's just another way of looking at what you see here below. But there is little consensus on the identity of these figures as Egyptian deities because of the inconsistency of the attributes associated with each figure. However, and this I discovered through the reading of this chapter, they are associated with the 12 signs of the zodiac, as we'll discover when we consider the illustration that appears in the center of the page. There are also 12 figures in the lower third of the tablet, which, according to Levi, represented the, quote, corresponding distribution of labor or work periods throughout the year, meaning the nature of human labor associated with each zodiacal house. Here are the upper and lower registers in proximity. Finally, Levi tells us that the middle register contains 21 sacred signs answering to the letters of a mystical alphabet, and that each symbol represents a specific cosmic principle or spiritual truth. So more on this in a bit. Next, in the midst of all is a seated figure of the pantomorphic Ainx, or I-Y-N-X. I'm not sure if it's meant to be pronounced or not. Emblem of universal being and corresponding as such to the Hebrew Yod, or to that unique letter from which all the other letters were formed. So this passage suggests that Isis, the central figure in is the Mensa Isiaca, and is a kind of universal agent, and as such, the source of all diversity, just as the Yod is the source of all the letters in the Hebrew alphabet. Pantomorphic means able to take all forms, which Isis, as the divine mother, is known for doing. According to Kircher, IYNX represents the foundation of the universe, here represented by Isis, which expresses itself through three triads, much like the three aspects of theosophy. Can we get a reader?
Yes, Ben, can you read that for us, please? Thanks.
The universe is regulated from the paternal foundation through three triads. This foundation is variously called the IYNX, Soul of the World, and Pantomorphic Redeemer, and by Philo, the Constructive Wisdom, and exists in the perfection of triads of Pater, Potentia, and Mater, or Mens, the Father, the Power, and the Mother, or Design, coexisting with faith, truth, and love, from the Isiac tablet of Cardinal Bembo.
Thank you. So we'll be getting into some of these qualities in a moment. Actually, probably next time, since we're almost out of time. So next up, the IYNX is encircled by the Ophite triad, answering to the three mother letters of the Egyptian and Hebrew alphabets. So Ophite refers to serpents, which we see on either side of the enclosure. The third is in the chamber beneath Isis. It's identified for us a little later. I see this figure is rising up out of a serpent body, but it's identified by Kircher as this sort of Sphinx-like figure. Could we get a reader for this, please? Oh, wait a minute. The third is the chamber beneath Isis. This passage from W. Wincott Westcott's The Isiac Tablet of Cardinal Bembo gives a further description. So now, could we get a reader, please?
Okay, Tom, can you read that for us, please? Oops, I guess Tom's gone. I'll read it. The two serpent figures V and W, with the central sphinx P, form the Ophionian Agatha demonic triad, or serpent good deities. Yeah, go ahead and say it right.
No, you said it right. Ophionian Agatha demonic triad. I was okay. Congratulating your pronunciation.
Yeah. Oh, serpent good deities, the symbols of the, pantomorphous spirit of the world, acting in the three spheres, intellectual, ethereal, and elementary.
Yeah. So the three mother letters associated with this triple serpent power are Aleph, Mem, and Sheen, representing air, water, and fire, respectively. They are considered, just as is Isis, the foundational elements from which all other letters, and by extension, all creation, are derived. So I hope you're getting the connection here, the idea that Isis stands at the very center. She's the unity principle, surrounded by the triplicity, or the threefold, and the Hebrew letters mirror that same philosophical idea of the unified source, which is beyond letter, but represented by the God, and then the three called mother letters, which are Aleph, Mem, and Sheen. Okay. Next, on the left are the Ibimorphic and Serapian triads. On the right are those of Nephthys and Hecate, representing active and passive fixed and volatile, fructifying fire and generating water. The term ibomorphic refers to forms relating to the ibis, which is sacred to the Egyptian god Thoth, god of wisdom, knowledge, and learning. The two gods most associated with Thoth are Ma'at, the goddess of truth, justice, and cosmic order, and Seshat, Thoth's female counterpart, as goddess of writing, knowledge, and wisdom. However, these three are not a traditional trinity. In fact, there is no recognized quote-unquote ibomorphic or ibomorphic triad in Egyptian iconography. This exists just within the logic of the Isiac tablet. Nor is there any traditional Serapian triad, though in context having to do with resurrection and the afterlife, Serapis is found depicted with Isis and Harpocrates. The point being that you're not going to find the key to the Isiac tablet by searching in traditional Egyptian iconography. It has its own intrinsic logic. At first, I completely dismissed it. When I found out it was made, you know, in Roman times and not by an Egyptian, I almost skipped the whole chapter. But then when I started reading about it, I realized that it very much has its own internal revelatory divine logic, you could say, or it's like its own philosophic teaching tool. So Nephthys formed two triads, depending on context. As part of the great Ennead of Heliopolis, she is often associated with her sister Isis, you see him here, together praising her brother Osiris. In other contexts, she is seen with Set, her consort, and Anubis, her son, in some myths. In Greek mythology, Hecate is a goddess of magic, witchcraft, and crossroads. She is often associated with the triad of goddesses known as the triple goddess, which includes Persephone and Demeter. This triad represents the three phases of the moon and the stages of a woman's life, maiden, mother, and crone. So, with this cursory introduction to the gods and goddesses cited, let's look at the statement again. On the left are the ibomorphic and Serapian triads. On the right are those of Nephthys and Hecate, representing active and passive, fixed and volatile, fructifying fire and generating water. So each pair of triads, and I'm looking at this is two pair and this is two pair. The red gel delineates the second triad on each side, represent energetic opposites, with Thoth and the solar Serapis representing the active, fiery, volatile aspect, and Nephthys and Hecate representing the quote-unquote passive, fixed, water-generating aspect. So with, however, except for the ibis-headed Thoth-like figure, identifying the gods and goddesses as they appear in the central panel of the Mensa Isiaca, is not easily done, since the attributes associated with the gods, as illustrated in the table, are not consistent with the known attributes of the gods as found in Egyptian writing and art. Nonetheless, the Mensa Isiaca does have its own internal logic, which we'll discover as we continue to explore. And that will be next time. So thank you all. I think it's a fascinating artifact and was happy to discover that it does have some meaning, which we'll look into next time. So
Okay, first, before I give the dates, Greg says, is the one way of describing the esoteric astrological expression or symbol of esoteric planetary Venus that can also be related to the metaphorical expression of Isis in Egyptian context. And then he says, for esoteric Venus is sacred in a sort of twin to esoteric planetary Earth, we might identify through Master DK's teachings. And there's also the fifth ray sacred element, the Venus.
Yeah, there's a definite connection between the myth and the theosophical teaching. You know, I would put Osiris in the position of the Earth, you know, who was cut into 14 parts and has to be resembled. That's very much references our process of becoming, you could say, reassembling the fragmented or separating principles of ourselves. Whereas Isis, in one context, this is not the full story of Isis, but in one context can represent the feminine aspect of Venus, the second ray and second and sixth ray monad in comparison to that fifth ray mind. It's a big, that's a deep and big subject, very interesting. Okay, and any other comments?
No, that's the last comment, but I got to give the dates. So, coming up next is Treatise on Cosmic Fire on the 14th of March. And because the US and Canada changed to daylight savings time, that will start at 7 p.m. GMT. Okay. And everything after that.
All right. Good to know.
Okay. The Secret Doctrine on the 16th of March at 7 p.m. GMT. And then the next Secret Teaching of All Ages will be on the 6th of April at 7 p.m. GMT.
Okay.
So, and, thank you, Varun.
Yeah. And also I'd like to, you know, give the dates for the Treatise on Cosmic Fire, because there's one that's canceled for this month. So the, what is the second Friday?
No, not for March. It looks like you've got the 14th of March and the 28th of March. It's the one on the 11th of April that is canceled because of the pre-full moon webinar that you'll be doing.
Okay. All right. Good to have that clarified. Okay. So we're pretty much on for all the webinars this month then. We're on schedule, no special circumstances. So good.
Yeah, not this month, but there's going to be other special circumstances in April, but we'll get to that when we get to that.
Yeah, April, there's some deletions because of the coming conference. And the
and times and stuff like that. So, okay.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Francis.
And thank you. Thank you all for attending. We'll see you next time. Much love. Take care.
Bye-bye, everybody.